somebody say, hey, like what you said at camp, I thought about that when I was in a bad spot racing and I got through that spot. Like that's like, that gives me goosebumps right now. Like that, that's a win for me. That's like, that's way better than standing on the top step of a podium.
Welcome to the Veloworthy Podcast. I'm your host, Brian Coe. In this series, we head to Steamboat Springs, Colorado, and head to the SBT Gravel Race and talk to some of the participants of the event. Stay tuned for what will be an exciting series brought to you by Chamois Butter. Welcome to the show, and as the intro said, we're excited to bring you a new series of three episodes coming up in the future of gravel riding. We head to Colorado and went to the SBT Gravel event, and we didn't just cover the race or the ride. We actually talked to some of the people who were real big personalities within the sport, maybe what they love about the sport, what the sport could do to improve, all those things. So stay tuned for that. The intro is Yuri Hoswald, and we will get to him in just a bit. But first, we're going to talk to our resident attorney and friend, Josh Benici at BeniciLawGroup.com. We talked to him about some different cases where drivers are harassing cyclists, but not necessarily breaking the law. They're bending it a little, maybe walking right up to it. But what do you do in those situations? So please remember, Josh Benici is an attorney, but he's not your attorney. So for your legal advice, please consult one. But without further ado, let's go ahead and get to Ask a Lawyer with Josh Benici. We are back with Josh Benici of BeniciLawGroup.com. You can find him on Facebook as well as Instagram as SD Bike Lawyer. Welcome back, Josh.
Thanks for having me.
So today I want to talk about, let's say you're a cyclist, you're doing all the right things, and then inevitably, wherever you're riding, there's just something that maybe sparks or triggers something in a driver that says, I hate you. Mm-hmm. And not only are they just going to pass you and go on their day, but they want to do something to let you know that they hate you.
So
teach you a lesson, you know, for making you slow down for 5 seconds. And there are the sort of types of harassment that drivers do when it comes to not necessarily harming the cyclist, but definitely harassing. So yeah. There's things like rolling coal, and there's this great image on social media about a driver that was just, you know, hit the gas pedal on their diesel and just blew up this plume of smoke. But drivers doing things like driving aggressively, laying on the horn, driving too close. I've had water thrown at me, mm-hmm. Just a water bottle empty, but like someone shake a bottle and throw it at me. I've had aluminum cans of adult and non-adult beverages thrown at me before. None of them had hit me, fortunately. But what can cyclists do in those cases? And are what they doing, is it illegal?
I mean, it's definitely assault. And that is something where it's assault, possibly battery, and causing the unwanted touching upon somebody else, right?
Okay.
It's also endangerment, you could argue, saying that, you know, throwing an unopened adult beverage at you, while it might sound refreshing, I mean, if you're going 20 miles an hour and it hits you, you know, you lose balance, it hits your front wheel, it gets stuck in your spokes, you go down. I mean, there's could be catastrophic injury there, right? Yeah, definitely, it's illegal. Again, the hard part with this stuff is enforcement, right? Who's there to see it? Are you running a camera? You know, a lot of these safety cameras now, if you're running a GoPro, you get their license plate number, you can actually see what has happened, you can report it. Where it goes from there is kind of out of your hands, but that is something that you could upload and send to your local law enforcement. And I've heard that it has been taken seriously from time to time. I had an instance at a local route here in SoCal, Great Western Loop, where we were coming down the downhill, we were cooking, and a large SUV passed myself and my friend in front of me, came inches in front of them. And a guy behind me kind of waved at him, like, what was that all about? Guy pulled over, yelled at us, videoed us on his phone. We just kept riding. Well, one of the guys took a picture of the car and ended up sending it in to the local sheriff. We found out this wasn't his first time doing it, and that they promised that an officer was actually going to go talk to him at his house after that. Really? Because this was a repeat offense.
They make so, house calls. Nice.
Does that happen every time? I don't know. But I feel like documenting those things, you know, yours could be the straw that breaks the camel's back. Or, you know, if this guy unfortunately hits somebody later on, but there's evidence that this has happened before, this could ratchet it up from, you know, to a more serious charge or something. Unfortunately, this is what we have to really, I think, rely on, because enforcement, there aren't cops in every single corner, which is fine. Mm-hmm. However, there just never is when you need one in these kind of instances.
Exactly. And what about those cyclists that are like, I'm going to confront this person, and the person's pulled over, and tensions are high.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Both people have their phones out, and they're yelling at each other, and they're both recording, and yep. They both think that they're right. What is, from a legal standpoint, from your standpoint, what's sort of the best way to handle that?
That's a trick question.
I mean, say like someone just buzzed you intentionally, then pulled over, and
right. Let's
duke it out, or, you know, because that kind of stuff does happen.
Oh, tempers flare so easily, and you know, you always want to avoid any type of altercation like that. If someone's acting aggressively towards you, taking a picture, recording, documenting it somehow, to again sending it out to authorities to alert them of what's going on, let your GoPro run. You know, unfortunately, people are very unpredictable, so kind of doing that and kind of taking that justice into your own hands can be quite risky, right? So my unofficial, official legal advice is to try to avoid that. But, you know, in the
heat, just keep moving forward.
Try to capture what happened if you can with being safe, and, you know, try to get into a more populated area. I've had stories of, you know, you take a picture and all of a sudden the car's following you. Go into a parking lot and hang out. You know, if you feel like it's a very dangerous situation, call 911.
Like someone's stalking, not stalking, but just won't leave me alone, keeps following me.
The continued harassment.
Okay.
Yes. You know, call your local emergency line for sure. It's not worth it. And again, you're documenting the event. It seems redundant. It seems silly, but it can be important.
Do you see in court cases that if you're like, well, I have GoPro footage or action cam footage, do juries watch that in court, and do you show them that kind of thing?
We do our best to have the jury be able to see it. A lot of times, you know, the defense wants to try to keep those things out. But, you know, a lot of times we are successful to show the jury exactly what happened. And it's funny because I feel like sometimes the footage doesn't look as bad, and sometimes it looks worse than it is. So it is interesting to see kind of the reactions when the jury does look at these types of videos or pictures or anything like that. But videos can be great, especially when liability is disputed, to show how hard a fall was, to show how fast a cyclist was going. Because when you say 20 miles an hour, you think in your car, man, 20 miles an hour is really slow.
Yeah.
Like, I hate it when there's 25 mile an hour speed zone. But 20 miles an hour with the wind blowing against a GoPro or something where you can hear it, you can kind of see around you that it's just open.
Right,
you don't have anything protecting you. That visualization, or even the sound of the crash, can be, can be stimulating.
First of all, I ride with a action cam, a cyclic. It's a rear view one, but it has like this sort of wide angle.
Mm-hmm.
So even if I've had those days where it's like, man, the car got close, I'm gonna do the instant replay at home on my computer. It doesn't look like they're coming close.
Because the angle's so wide.
Because the angle's wide.
Yeah.
So I wonder if that is not emphasizing enough what reality is versus what the camera picks up.
Then that could be tough, right? The distortion. Because you know what? You want the angle to be able to pick up what's going on around you, right? But it's not going to be a perfect science.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what's usually the defense's reasoning for saying, no, we can't show footage?
It's too biased, or it, you know, it's
the camera is like impartial. It's the camera.
To not get in the weeds, sometimes they may say, okay, you know what, we're going to admit liability. We're going to say, yeah, okay, our guy was at fault, so let's not talk about too much on how it happened. Let's just talk about how it affected you, because they feel that if the jury sees the video and the video is pretty serious, your bike rolls a couple of times, or it hears you screaming in pain. Right.
Right.
Those are things that can be kept out, and that's a game time decision. It's called a motion in limine that happens days before trial. So wow. it's they're short, to-the-point motions, and the judge rules on them, and then that determines whether or not the jury hears it. So that's the risk a lot of times of going to trial on cases is, you know, you work on a case for 3 years, you've got all this evidence, and, you know, the defense or any party can bring a motion to exclude a particular piece of evidence, and then all of a sudden the jury doesn't get to hear about it or see it or something. So it is a possibility. It depends on, you know, the facts of what's going on and if they're admitting liability, what the video shows, right?
So as long as the defense says, okay, we admit liability, because we do that, we ask you not to show it. Have you said in cases, no, we're going to show it anyway, or okay, we agree, we're not going
to
show it?
Well, we always fight it, and then it's up to the judge. You oppose the motion.
Okay.
Right, and then it's up to the judge to determine according to the law. And there's evidence codes saying whether or not certain pieces of evidence should come in based on certain factors. You have to weigh the factors according to the case, and then the judge ultimately makes that decision.
Okay. I'm curious, in defense, do they bring up their own expert cyclist sort of witnesses or experts to give information? I'm just curious because it seems like if you're dealing with the driver and their insurance company, They don't have Lance Armstrong to like talk about, you know, the expert, like, and you are an expert. You're a cyclist. You race bikes. You're doing Leadville and you did BWR and all these things. So you have that advantage. Does the defense sort of have something like that in their back pocket?
You know, I haven't run across that yet. It'd be interesting to see who they would pull out of their pocket as an expert.
Because you would probably know them or have ridden with
right?
them
yeah.
at some
yeah,
point.
Yeah, you beat me at that race. But you know that would come towards, I think, what would the, where a cyclist reasonably would position themselves, where they would ride, or something like that. I would think, and I haven't had a case that was come down to something that particular, I guess, but I wouldn't put it past them. That wouldn't surprise me if that came up, and then it would just be basically pitted against, you know, my client who, you know, if they're a novice cyclist or whatnot. But it really goes into, not everybody has to have the cycling acumen of a Peter Sagan or a Lance Armstrong, right? It needs to be of who you are. So they have to look at, okay, did you just start cycling 2 weeks ago? Have you been, you know, were you a pro tour rider before? We have to take for who you are for that.
Gotcha.
Right. So an expert could be hired. It'd just be really interesting to see how that would play out. I have not seen that yet.
Okay.
When I do, I will let you know.
Always interesting. Josh Benici, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, we hear from gravel rider Yuri Hoswald. Are you a cyclist in need of an attorney? Well, look no further because Benici Law Group is here to help. They have 3 full-time attorneys who deal specifically with bicycle accidents. They cover all types of cases, and not to mention, Josh Benici is not only a lawyer, but he's a cyclist himself. He's participated in the Belgian Waffle Ride as well as Leadville, and has sponsored teams such as the local SDBC team and the SD Velodrome. For more information, check out BeniciLawGroup.com or SDDisabilityAttorney.com. During the inaugural SBT Gravel Race in Steamboat Springs, Colorado, we partnered with Chamois Butter. In talking with some of the participants about their cycling backgrounds, ideas, and experience, as well as the wisdom both on and off the bicycle, we boarded the Chamois Butter Jeep and drove around scenic Steamboat as we chatted and had a great time in the process. In our 3-episode series, we talk first with gravel cycling legend Yuri Hoswald. Yuri has been a cyclist for many years and an outdoor enthusiast for even longer. As a child, running around on a farm, camping outdoors, and not having a TV in the home was the norm. As a cyclist, he's competed in just about every discipline and has found a new love for gravel cycling. We meet up with Yuri as we head out on the SBT gravel course.
The thing is, your first gravel bike was what, like a mountain bike with drop bars?
let's see. I guess my first gravel bike was a cross bike. You know, I didn't discover gravel until 2013 is when I did my first Dirty Kanza, and I did it on a Marin Cortina, which was their cross bike.
2013. So yeah. Gravel wasn't even a market yet at that point. Were you still sort of just like
doing things and figuring it out as you went?
Yeah, I mean, I was, you know, I stumbled into gravel because I worked for Goo Energy Labs and we were a sponsor of Dirty Kanza. I'd never heard of Dirty Kanza before. It sounded interesting, something different.
Yeah.
I did a lot of endurance mountain bike racing. And so I decided to go out in 2013 and race it and fell in love with gravel. I would say, you know, right around that time is when you started to see industry shift in them really focusing on that new niche and developing bikes and tires and bags and packs and shoes and grupos and everything gravel, you know.
And clothing.
all of that.
And aero gravel bikes and e-gravel bikes.
E-gravel bikes and different tire treads and this and that. So, yeah, it's exploded in since the, you know, 6 years that I first discovered DK.
So when do you think, was there even a, can you even say, like, there's the birth date of gravel? Like, when was gravel born? Some people say, like, 90s with Tomac riding drop bars on his mountain bike.
Yeah.
Some people say, well, you know, it's just recently.
Yeah.
Because, I don't know, I was talking to one of the earlier dudes, and he's like, well, the roads have always been there. The gravel trails have always been there. It's the technology that's actually catching up.
Yes.
To where we can actually afford to ride, and it can be fun, and we're not beat up on our road bikes.
Yeah.
On 19 mil wide tires.
Exactly. So, I mean, I would argue, you know, and I'm not from the Midwest and I don't know the gravel scene that well, but I would argue that, I mean, gravel's been happening since, you know, the 70s or the 80s, right? When people just out riding their road bikes, like you said, on dirt roads or their mountain bikes. You know, DK, I think, is what, almost 15 years old now?
Really?
Yeah. This, I think 2020 will be, I think, possibly their 15th year. So, I'm sure there were gravel events prior to that, but definitely within the last 6 years, you've just seen an explosion of technology and popularity and events. I mean, there's, I think, three different events just happening this weekend, you know, that are pulling people in different directions, right? You have Gravel Worlds, you have a Roll Massif event, and you have this.
Forcing people to choose.
Choose, for sure. Definitely. But it's a really healthy cycling calendar, which is great. But yeah, there's a lot of choices out there right now.
And the thing is, too, like, when DK first started, it was very just low, just local, grassroots.
Yep.
Where I live, BWR was and is still a road race, but with dirt in it. And now it's evolved into what people call gravel.
Yeah.
And then now we're at SBT, and this is so weird because I've never seen an event with so much panache, I guess. I don't know if that's the right word to choose.
Yeah.
But buildup, that it's not grassroots. It's big.
Yeah, it's big.
And it's got big names. It's got a lot of money.
Yep.
It's got a lot of backing.
It's got a big women's field, which is great. That was one of the big initiatives or pushes for the event, was to have more parity, to have, you know, a larger women's field. It's also awesome that they're doing equal payout, which is not necessarily common this day and age yet, unfortunately.
No, right? I'd say if you look at all the cycling disciplines, road is probably the worst if you're a woman trying to make a living at it.
Yes.
And it's, you know, a lot of them have second jobs or third jobs or
for sure
school or
definitely
whatnot.
Definitely.
So you've ridden this area.
I haven't ridden too much here, man. I mean, the extent of my riding goes back to yesterday. You know, I haven't, I've never ridden in here. That's one of the things I'm most excited about, is checking out new terrain.
When did you first start riding bikes?
I mean, as a kid, but I had a career playing lacrosse in high school and college. That was my ticket to college. So I was a collegiate lacrosse player, at Cal Berkeley. And, I picked up a bike in 1994, 95, when I was teaching at a prep school in Pennsylvania.
Wow.
That's when I started riding. So very late in life, when I was 24.
There's a lot of roadies doing this race.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, the horsepower is going to be through the roof.
But you're probably pretty good at the technical.
I'm good at technical riding, for sure. That's where I shine, because my roots are in mountain biking.
Right.
So I do well in technical stuff. I'm also, you know, obviously people, they can see me. I'm not a climber. So like a rolly power course kind of suits me, but I don't have, you know, pro tour power or fitness.
Like you're not 130 pounds?
I'm not 130 pounds. I'm quite the opposite. So, yeah.
That's the thing. Like, it requires a good deal of power. I was looking at Colin's power file from DK.
Colin's ridiculous.
And he was doing like almost 300 watts for 10 hours.
Yeah.
For 10 freaking hours. And I'm like thinking, how is that even... Next up, we talk about Yuri's pro lifestyle, as well as some of the more consistent and methodical routines he uses while on the road to become more efficient. It's becoming very much part of the job,
I don't mind this part of my job. I mean, I'm really lucky to be able to call this my job. I mean, I turned 49 this year, and it's like I get to do this for a living. It's pretty crazy.
So you're on the road a ton.
Yeah, I'm on the road a ton. For work and play. So work and play are blurred for me big time.
Okay.
Because of my job title.
What's your official job title?
Official job title is Elite Athlete Manager for Goo Energy Labs. So okay. I deal with all of our elite athletes, and I do community outreach. I do a lot of camps and... attend events and work with kids, and my wife runs a NorCal High School cycling league, so I volunteer with them when I can and speak to teams, and then I still have my whole athlete side of my life too, so I go to races, but a lot of the races I go to Goo sponsors, so that's why work and play become blurred. And I'm lucky, you know, to be able to come to an event like SBT Gravel and not have to like work the booth.
Right.
We have
being on your feet all day, answering questions.
Yeah, we have other folks that are activating the booth. But there have been years in the past, you know, where I activate the booth and then I race. And so it's just been a sort of slow progression over the last 6-7 years to get to this point where I'm at right now in my career.
But in a lot of ways, it's almost like just like a lifestyle, you know?
Yeah, that's funny you say that because, you know, I do get to say I have PRO, pro, you know, in my title, but I'm more pro lifestyle than like pro athlete, I think. You know, especially when I look at the talent that's at this event, you know, I'm not on the far end of the really athletically gifted spectrum. I'm probably somewhere more in the middle. So, but I think I do a pretty good job of being, you know, pro lifestyle and an ambassador for the brands that I ride for and doing stuff like this.
So is it hard to sort of juggle all the different hats you have to wear? Or is it, I read this article about like work-life balance is a myth, just embrace the chaos. It's kind of funny because like people strive and get stressed out trying to balance everything. And in the end, you're always going to leave someone unhappy.
Yeah. It can be difficult for sure to balance it all. You know, staying on top of my email interactions with the athletes I deal with or events or trying to get bikes in time, you know, for events like this to be built up for shoots with magazines, you know, juggling logistics of traveling and things like that. Still trying to be a good husband, right? You know, a dog dad. It goes in waves, you know. Sometimes it's more stressful than others. Sometimes it's easy and everything just comes together. But I've had a little bit of stress rolling into this event for sure.
Yeah. Is it, when you're looking back on the years you've ridden longer than most people have.
True.
Are there...
Pays to be old, bro.
Well, you have experience.
Yes, yeah.
And you know, like, I know how to, like, I'm sure for you, like, pinning on a number, you can do it in your sleep with your eyes closed.
Yeah.
Whereas somebody's figuring that out minutes before they... And that's just one less thing. Like, I've learned, like, the more routine you make it, and especially for travel,
And the more consistent you try and keep it,
yeah,
the less you have to keep track of or get stressed out about.
Yeah.
So do you have like a secret formula for like, you know, for those people that are on the road and they're traveling? Because you have a PhD in that.
I have a PhD in traveling. I do have a PhD in van life for sure. Yeah, having the routines, it definitely helps. I mean, I know exactly like what nutrition I'm going to use, so I don't even have to think about it. You know, I just, mm-hmm. I have it in my bag. I pull it out. I'm not like tweaking on, am I going to, you know, have more drink or more gels or this or that. I just know exactly what I'll need. You know, packing the correct gear, obviously, or laying out your gear the night before an event is a good routine to just help sort of lower your stress levels. But like you said, I've been riding a bike for 20 plus years now. Yeah. So I kind of have all those routines down. So like getting prepped for an event doesn't stress me out anymore. Like it's kind of rote, you know,
yeah, it's just do it. Like, yeah. Calming.
Yeah.
You know, you have your bag a certain way.
Yep, I do.
Shoes a certain
yep.
way.
Yep. Totally.
And I'm sure you may have had those days when you were competing and you're like, I forgot my helmet. I forgot my sunglasses.
Yep, I forgot my shoes. Yeah, or something like that. Or I forgot my chamois and I have to borrow a friend's chamois that's too small, you know? Yeah, so, yeah, definitely had those, but those are fewer than the opposite of having everything, so.
So what would you say to somebody who's like fairly new to the sport, gravel cycling?
Yeah.
And maybe they've never raced on the road or on a mountain bike, but they want to do these events. And they, maybe a lot of them don't just want to finish, but they want to maybe get a good time or
yeah.
PR or whatever the case may be. I mean, are training plans even written for this kind of thing? Or are people just making it up as they go?
Oh, no, definitely. Training plans exist. There's tons of companies out there, you know, Training Peaks, Carmichael Training Systems. I work with a coach named Adam Pulford. I mean, there's tons of different training programs out there to fit all the different lifestyles. You know, you need to obviously pick one that works with your like work and life, mm-hmm. Because balancing three things, you know, training and your life and then work can be tricky. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there are plenty of resources out there as far as training. And I wouldn't even, you know, necessarily throw somebody into the deep end of a whole training plan right out of the gate. I would just say, start riding gravel more, and you don't even need to have a specific gravel bike to enjoy gravel. You can do it on your mountain bike, right? Or right. a road bike with a little bit thicker tires or something like that. But just, if they're wanting to get into it, just start riding more, like consistent riding.
Yeah.
You'll see improvements. And then if you want to take the next step, then you could like add in training with power or heart rate or doing things with your diet or doing specific intervals. But I like to always go back to the root. And for me, the root is fun, having fun. Mm-hmm. And so I would encourage people just to start by having fun on a new surface like gravel before they get too deep into training.
Yeah, and I noticed, for the most part, at least because I come from a road background, cycling is kind of a solitary sport.
Yeah.
Because you're out there riding by yourself on your own time, your own schedule. But then when you come to these big events, it's like a fat community.
Huge.
And so it's kind of this weird thing. You're by yourself. You're training for this thing or riding, prepping for this big event. And then you're here and it's like, it's all your friends.
Yeah.
So in a way, it's like a reunion.
It is. That's one of the things I loved most about gravel when I first discovered it in 2013 was the gravel family or the gravel community. I don't mean to bash on road or mountain biking.
Oh, we can bash on road.
Can we bash on road?
I've crashed so many times.
Yeah, no, me too. I don't do crits anymore because I've crashed way too many times in road crits. But I feel like gravel is this nice sort of cross-section or meeting place of road and mountain. And it's all about the community, the family. It's all about the experience. Yeah, there will be that 5-10% of folks who are all worried about their performance and trying to be, you know, the fastest or whatever. But it seems like the majority of folks are out here for the experience, the community. And that's what I really dig the most about the gravel scene. And, you know, in my 6-7 years of riding gravel now, this is like a big reunion for me. I mean, I see friends here from Kansas and California and Texas and all over the place. Met a dude today from Florida, you know, new guy just out on the coffee ride. So It's been awesome. Yeah, because I've seen so many people get turned off to cycling through a race where someone cut them off, or something happened where they are just, you know, there's hurt feelings.
Yeah.
You can't really blame other people in a gravel race unless you're like fighting for first place and there's something that went wrong.
Yeah.
Like it's, I think it's more 100% on you.
Yeah.
You know, there's no team. Well, there are teams.
There are teams, which is interesting because you do that. That is an aspect of gravel where road is bleeding into the gravel scene. He's telling us to stop. You know, you're starting to see more road tactics bleed into gravel, especially with like, you know, EFs and the bigger road teams showing up at some events. I mean, you were seeing road tactics in gravel even before the Pro Tour teams showed up. I mean, you had the Panaracer gravel team.
Oh, yeah.
That was skin suits, road shoes, road pedals, possibly an earpiece so they could communicate with each other. I'm not kidding.
What are they even going to talk about?
I don't know. That's a good question,
man. They
can't
call the team car up.
I will share that during one DK, I was riding behind somebody who had an earpiece, and I jokingly said, "Can you call in for a pizza, bro?" But he didn't find it that funny. So,
oh, I would have laughed.
Yeah, right? So, yeah, I mean, it's part of the evolution of the sport, I think, you know? And those who want to embrace that side of it, great. Those who don't, that's great, too.
I mean, I would say, though, if it got to that point, it would make it a little bit more... a higher barrier to entry, because then you would have people going, "Oh, can I get on that team? Here's my race resume."
Yeah.
Which is what you see in road racing. And
you do.
Like, oh, well, let's see your race results or something. And
I mean, I think that's going to always appeal to a small segment of folks. And then you'll have, you know, the bulk of people, at least in my experience, seem to be here for the experience, you know, and meeting new people, seeing new places, pushing themselves physically. But yeah, you'll always have people who will want to go fast and be a part of a team because they're the fast team.
After a quick break in the chamois butter Jeep, Yuri and I talk about the work-life balance myth or reality that he has to face sometimes on a regular basis.
This is a big one.
Oh,
do you see cycling as work?
That's a good question because, like we were saying earlier, like my job sort of blends work and play. I do see it as I do see what I do as a job, like being an ambassador for brands that I ride for, and obviously representing Goo Energy Labs, who pays my salary. That's a job. I want to be the best ambassador, representative for them that I can. And obviously part of my job is interacting with elite athletes and stuff like that. So I want to be attentive to their needs and take care of them. And, but it's a very fun job. You know, I mean, there's that, the cliche that, like, you know, you do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life. Right.
That's
me,
true.
Right. I'm doing what I love. And it's considered work, but, most of the times it does not feel like a burden or work to me.
But it's not also in the sense of like, okay, it's raining, I got to go out and do intervals.
Well, there are days like that too, though, you know?
Really?
I mean, there are days where, like, I don't want to go out and train in the conditions, but I know I have to. So, yeah, maybe that's a day where it feels a little bit more like work. But, like, it's hard to complain about having to ride your bike for work. You know what I mean? Like,
that's
doing
true.
Intervals in the rain, like, and that's considered your job? Like, that's a pretty good job.
Are you still riding on the road a bunch?
The irony of my situation and where I live is that I spend like 98% of my time on my road bike training because we don't have gravel in Northern California, really. And the gravel that we do have isn't near where I live. So just for efficiency, management of lifetime, I spend a ton of time on my road bike.
You know, I've equated training on your road bike for gravel. Like, say you go to high school, right?
Yeah.
And you want to perform well on the test, and you're the cool guy, which is the gravel guy.
Yeah.
You want to make friends with the nerds, which are the road dudes who study and prep yeah,
and practice,
yeah,
and then on when they perform because, yeah, like those guys have serious engines.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, I'm gonna make friends with the roadies tomorrow for sure, dude. I'm gonna try to, you know, hang on to Ted, Jake Wells, Colin, all those guys, for sure.
But even if you look at guys like Ted, I think they've fully converted.
Oh yeah, you know for I sure. Like, Ted's definitely embraced gravel. I mean, he and his wife Laura King just put on an amazing event in Vermont called Rooted, which was a gravel event, you know, to celebrate their local community. So yeah, he's embraced it wholeheartedly. I mean, I would still say Ted probably has a lot of roadie in him, and he'd probably say the same thing. So, yeah. Yeah.
But I think one day, I don't know when, we may have the first person who's never done road or ever done mountain biking and only done gravel. Like, say who's a kid who's like 10 years old.
Possible.
And they grow up only knowing gravel, and yeah, they become a gravel cyclist.
Yeah.
That could be...
That's totally that possible. I mean... If you think, I mean, it makes total sense because in the Midwest, the gravel roads are the safest and most scenic roads to ride, right? Less traffic.
Put your belt on it.
Oh, what's that?
I was wondering where that beep was coming from. But yeah, like, and the other thing too is like, do they really want to ride during rush hour?
No.
On a road where, and people are seeing more on social media, you know, driver hits someone from behind, they get a slap on the wrist at most.
It's horrible, man. I've been hit twice in my career by cars, and I know people who've been hit. I know people who've been killed. It's really unfortunate. So, like, gravel roads are really safe to be on. And so, yeah, it makes sense. I mean, yeah, someday that we will have just a pure gravel cyclist.
Pure gravel cyclist, and then one day you're like, and this is a road bike.
Yeah, or right?
They're like, what's that? Yeah. Like, that's a time trial bike. Yeah, like, never heard of it.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't think we're there yet.
No.
But one day. And that's the other thing, too. You never know how it's going to evolve.
Yeah.
And change into, I think it's kind of whatever you make it.
Well, I don't think anybody would have necessarily looked into their crystal ball 6, 7, 8 years ago and been like, gravel's going to be where it is now, right?
Yeah.
Seen that explosion of technology, of, you know, brands creating whole lines of bikes that are purely just gravel bikes and packs and tires and, you know, all the gear that's come along with it.
Have you ever seen anything on the... gravel marketing side going, is this more marketing or is this really a functional thing? Like, do we really need aero gravel bikes?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, like, perfect case in point would be a bike that hasn't seen the light of day, but it has been announced, is Niner's new Magic Carpet Ride, the MCR.
Oh, that thing's a
which
beautiful,
is a beautiful, beautiful bike. I've ridden it. I've put hundreds of miles on it. But it's a full suspension drop bar mm-hmm. bike. And as people will do, there are haters out there that are like, well, that's just a full suspension mountain bike with drop bars. Like, you guys are just, it's just the marketing spin. You're trying to sell more bikes. And while there's probably some truth in that, mm-hmm. For an aging endurance athlete like myself, who loves to spend hundreds of miles on gravel roads, a full suspension gravel bike is pretty sweet, bro.
Oh, yeah.
It takes the edge off. Like, I can ride longer and harder now because my body's taking less of a beating. Super fun to rip the descents. So yeah, there are things out there that are pure just marketing spin for people to try to sell more units. But then there are some really cool, genuine, like unique inventions that are helping change this sport for sure. Yeah.
And as the sport grows. With anything new, I think you'll always have your purists
yeah.
that are like, no, it has to be this way. It's almost yeah. like people who are like into punk music. It's like, it's not punk enough. You're yeah. using these chords wrong.
Exactly.
It's
not, yeah.
It doesn't follow this beat. Yeah. Like, it gets so narrowed that it's yeah. like, well, is it really like, are we going to be the next, you know, UCI with our measuring sticks?
Yeah, for your socks.
Like, is it gravel enough?
Yeah, right? Your socks are too tall, bro. Yeah, that's a violation. Yeah. Yep.
So I think part of the thing is, like, just the innovation side, too. Like, where people are just doing what they do.
Yeah.
I mean, who's the first person to put on aero bars? Was it you?
No way, dude. I've never, no way. Come on, that was a slap in the face, man. No, I've never used aero bars before. And nothing against people who use them, but like, I've never used aero bars before. No. And that's a whole nother topic. That's a whole nother can of worms. I don't even know if we want to dive into that one, but like, no. But like on the innovation side, like one of the things I love most about my, you know, air quotes job is that I get to do innovation, product innovation, whether it's nutrition with Goo or I helped develop the Chase Vest with Camelback, who's one of my sponsors, which was an idea that we sort of spawned because I was using a run vest, super lightweight, when I was doing my first DKs. And that sparked an idea like, hey, could we meld a run vest with a mountain vest and make something that would be more, you know, gravel? But it now, like, the Chase Vest is probably one of the most popular packs out there, but it's not just for gravel, but it was something that came out of, you know, hundreds of miles riding on the DK roads, right, and using their run pack and seeing what worked on that, which sparked this idea of sort of creating this blended pack. There's aero bars right there. Yeah. So that's been fun for me to like help innovate a little bit with some brands that I work with for some gravel specific things. But that Chase Vest, you know, you could use it on the mountain bike too, because you can still get to your pockets and it has chest stowage and all that stuff. So, yeah.
So where does all your drive, your inspiration, your work ethic? I mean, you told me you grew up on a farm, which I respect because I never baled hay until I was like in my teens, and I did it for a bike race.
Yeah.
And I was like, how do you, and I was so exhausted.
Yeah.
So is that just something that you're born with, or you had to learn how to become just a worker?
I'm gonna tip my hat to my parents for sure on this one, particularly my father, who's unfortunately no longer with us, but for the work ethic that was instilled in me. So growing up I really did not have a choice as to whether I worked or not. I worked.
So that was just your normal.
That was just the normal expected. You get up at 6 a.m. you go feed the pigs, the sheep, the chickens, whatever animals we had that year. My dad ran a construction company, so during every school break, probably starting from when I was, you know, a wee one, 10 or 11, would be on the job site with my dad and working. And so that just, I think, instilled in me this sense that, you know, that hard work can pay off, and that, you know, a lot of life takes dedicated hard work to get the results that you want. And so I'm gonna thank my father for instilling just a really deep work ethic in me. And my dad was tough as nails, so hopefully I've inherited some of that too.
And not a lot of people have that experience. Yeah. Today, not everybody gets to grow up with that environment.
Yeah. No, I think kids are, you know, and this
is,
we're not going to bash on millennials or anything. That's a good point. But like, yeah, kids have it a little bit easier these days. They're maybe more pampered or things like that, or things are taken care of for them. Whereas maybe, you know, I mean, I'm dating myself, but back in the mid 70s and early 80s or whatever, like it was expected that I worked. I had no choice, you know, come school breaks when friends were going here or there, it's like, I need you working. I got paid. It was awesome. I learned, you know, how to make money and the pride that you can get from that and buying your own things and stuff. But I really didn't have a choice growing up. And I think doing construction, and I did concrete work, it's difficult, tough work. And so I think all of that just played into my work ethic on the bike. And
so going from that to cycling's a cakewalk.
Cakewalk, dude. Easy.
You're like, this is nothing.
Easy.
Let's go, you know, hang drywall.
Yeah, totally. Exactly. Which is super heavy and hard.
Yeah, and brittle.
And yeah, totally. So, yeah, my parents definitely, and I inherited good genes, you know, athletically from them.
Were your parents pretty just outdoorsy kind of?
They were. You know, my mom was an aerobics instructor when I was growing up. My dad wasn't an athlete per se, but he was very athletic in many different things. We camped a lot. We would travel. So they just, you know, from an early age, I was taught an appreciation of the outdoors. And like I said, I grew up without a TV, so I spent a lot of time outdoors. We had 100 acres where I grew up, and so it was pretty common for me to just grab my tent and go pitch it up on our hill and spend the night up there. Yeah.
Wow.
When I was little with a buddy, just because it was fun.
Right.
Yeah.
And that kind of experience, man, I really think people need to get back to that.
Yeah. I mean, there people was something to be said for, like, I could go grab my pellet gun and go up on the hill and my parents wouldn't think, you know, a second thought about it, and I could go up there and do some target practice or this or that or roam the hills and be back in 3 hours and they wouldn't be worried because they knew I was somewhere on our property.
You know, that happened today, you know, the negligence.
But it also instilled in me, I think, this sense of, like, seeking adventure and, you know, going out and having fun in nature and the outdoors and just developing an appreciation for the outdoors. That stayed with me, you know, till now. I mean, I'm a van lifer. I live out of my van for a lot of the time. I've been on the road for 2 weeks in my van with my 130-pound Rhodesian Ridgeback, and my wife just joined me last week, and we have 2 more weeks on the road as we go from this to Rebecca's Private Idaho. But that's something I just I enjoy doing. We don't have children, so it makes it easier for us. Our child is our dog.
You have to homeschool them or something in the van.
But yeah, well, I was a school teacher in my past life, so I taught elementary school for 11 years. So that wouldn't be that hard. But yeah, it's just I'm a nomad, it's been fun. It's awesome.
Do you feel like you've accomplished everything you've wanted to within the sport, or are there still many, many stones to turn over?
You know, I don't know about, I mean, I always want to be the best athlete that I can be, but I also have to be really realistic about my athletic potential or capabilities as I age. And racing with dudes of pro tour caliber, 10, 15, 20 years younger than me. So that's something that I've had to come to terms with lately, is just sort of temper my expectations now, because I'm not as fast as I used to be. That's not to say that I don't want to be competitive or push myself or anything like that.
But you're still faster than 99% of everybody.
I'm still pretty fast, yes. As far as, like, accomplishments go, like, I'm never going to top winning Dirty Kansas, just to be totally honest. I mean, that was the pinnacle. I hate to say that that was the pinnacle of my career, and, you know, everything's been downhill since then, which not true at all. It's been actually uphill and even better. But when I won DK in 2015, that is hands down the biggest win I've ever had in my career. And I've had some pretty good wins in my career, but that would be the biggest and most meaningful for me, for sure. And one that did a tremendous amount for my career as, you know, a pro athlete. Or pro lifestyle athlete.
Exactly.
And opened many doors sponsorship wise for me, for sure.
So when it comes to the bike,
yeah,
how do you right now measure your worth in the sport? When you look at things from sort of like a macro view, a big wide view, is it race results? Is it a fun adventure? Is it the travel? Is it the friendships? Is there any one thing that sticks out in your mind that says, okay, this is how I measure my value in the sport?
Yeah. It's not race results. Definitely not race results. It would be the connections, the interactions that I have with racers, campers. Hopefully, and this gets back to the elementary school teacher in me, you know, hopefully when I go to these camps, I'm imparting some knowledge that allows people to you know, be their best personal athlete by using little bits of training tips I might have, or nutritional tips or gear tips or things like that. So for me now, like, what's most rewarding for me is to hopefully arm people with some skills and knowledge through the experience that I've gained over the last 20 years, and kind of, like, set them off on their own adventure. That's super rewarding for me. Like, to hear somebody say, hey, like, what you said at camp, I thought about that when I was in a bad spot racing and I got through that spot. Like, that's like, that gives me goosebumps right now. Like, that's a win for me. That's, like, that's way better than standing on the top step of a podium, or somebody who says, hey, I listened to your podcast and what you said about cancer or training or this or that really resonated with me and helped me because I'm in a similar situation, you know? So it's not about results anymore for me. It's more about the personal connections and experiences that I get to have with folks. And, yeah.
And for other people, if it is about results, that's a short-term thing. It's not going to last forever.
It's true. And, you know, I work with a lot of youth, and that's one of the first things that I tell them. I was like, if you're doing this solely for results, it's going to be a really empty experience at the end
Enjoy
of the day.
Enjoy it while you can, because you got to find something else.
Yeah.
I mean, for all we know, people could use your name as a verb, like, ooh, I Yuri'd that section. I made it through. I Yuri'd it.
I Yuri'd it. That's funny because I used to donate my old clothing to my wife's high school mountain bike team. Uh-huh. And I say this with all humility, I kind of have large calves and they blow out the tops of my socks. So when I would donate socks, the kids would be like, oh dude, these socks have been urified, man. The tops would be blown out of the socks. They're like, we can't wear these. They fall down. Oh, yeah. They've been urified.
Okay. So we have the calves. Yeah. That's part of the thing. Yeah. Now we have to come up with another, like, if they just grinded out a super epic day and they come back and they're like, how's the ride? Oh, I Yuri'd it.
I Yuri'd it. Yeah, that's what, I mean, it's all about just like grinding it out, persevering, pushing through the low points, celebrating the high points, because neither will last, right? You go through this ebb and flow of any race experience. And so, I Yuri'd it. I'd be honored if that became like a verb.
Okay, we'll start it.
Yeah, we could start it. Yeah,
with some of the people, and then when they go, "What?" I'll be what? Like, "Don't you know?"
Don't
already?
You know? Yeah,
it's a thing. People, come on! And then they'll just catch fire that way.
Yeah, like Urban Dictionary, we could get it in the Urban Dictionary.
Yeah, we'll put an entry in.
Yeah, Urban I Yuri'd it.
Man, so we're back where we
we're
started.
Back.
Thank you so much for coming out. This was super fun. I've never done a format like this before, but I couldn't think of a better person to do it with.
Oh, thanks, Brian. Yeah.
Dude.
It's great.
Legend.
Oh, no, I'm not. But thank you. Thank you very much. That was super fun.
Yuri Oswald is one of those writers who's kind of been there, done that, seen it all. And he's really found a niche within gravel cycling. So I appreciate his wisdom, his knowledge, his experience. He's got a great sense of humor as well. And you can probably find him at one of your major gravel events. And he's usually kind of at the pointy end of the pack still. And he's great. So that was our episode. For more information, reach out to me, Brian@veloworthy.com, as well as Instagram @veloworthy, as well as Facebook, veloworthy. It was fantastic. We cannot wait to bring you the next episode. So for Josh Benici and Yuri Oswald, this is Brian Coe saying, stay veloworthy.